play with the crowd.
You are listening to Radio Free Signs of the Times, broadcasting into the heart of an occupied America.
Welcome to another Signs of the Times podcast. My name is Dr. Gabriela Segura. I'm a health researcher for the Areolas Association, and I'm also a heart surgeon, but now I'm dedicated to alternative health research. I'm here tonight with great company.
I'm Doug DePasquale. I'm from Toronto, Canada. I'm a holistic nutritionist.
Aloha. My name is David Burt, and I have a small organic farm in Hawaii where we grow a number of diverse vegetables and fruits.
My name is Erica Whitbert, and I am also from Hawaii. I work on researching organic agriculture and educating the public about the health risks of genetically modified food.
So we see we're going to have a very interesting podcast tonight. We're all SOT editors, and we publish regularly on the health section of SOT and the Dot Connector magazine. And we're dedicated basically to publish important research that everybody needs to know regarding health matters nowadays. So, Dave, Erica, I heard that you were on TV recently informing the people about genetically modified foods. What is genetically modified foods?
Genetically modified food, or GMO, is when they take a gene of, say, a spider or a human being, and they splice it with the genes of a vegetable or a fruit. It's different than, say, like a hybrid vegetable where you take, say, two varieties of tomatoes and you cross-pollinate them, creating a third variety.
The movie that we recently did was one of three that have been produced on a local television station called Olelo, and it's shown around the state of Hawaii. Originally, we started off with just basic education about biotechnology, which is corporations that make genetically modified organisms. We also did a movie about food safety and security. And the final one that we just did was the ABCs of GMOs, opening Pandora's box in Hawaii. And we really wanted to stress the importance of people educating themselves about the safety issues associated with eating genetically modified food.
Some of the safety issues are what they call known unknowns. So basically the biotech companies are creating these GMO products, and they're very unstable. They have no idea what they're going to do once they're into the body or into the environment.
There has been some preliminary research, like in animal studies, where it showed that genetically modified foods actually create organ damage.
One of the first studies done was by a Dr. Puta. And what they did was they took genetically modified potatoes and they fed them to rats. And what they found, in fact, the doctor was actually pro-GMO. But after they started the research, they found that these rats that were fed the GMO potatoes, they started showing signs of smaller brains, immune problems, smaller hearts, smaller testicles. The doctor was very taken back by this. And when he tried to publish his results, he was attacked viciously by the biotech companies, and they basically ruined his career.
Well, that's pretty shocking. And I heard also that genetically modified foods can change the genetic information of the good bacteria in our guts, which is basically so important for our health, you know, having good bacteria in our gut.
Yeah, that's that's true. There are, studies that have been done that have found, it's particularly with the types of genetically modified corn and I believe soy as well, where these plants are actually they genetically engineered them so that they actually produce the pesticide Roundup within their genes. They're actually the DNA has been altered so that these plants are actually producing this pesticide, so that the farmers don't then have to spray it or anything like that, because it actually is giving off this pesticide. But unfortunately, that means that we're eating this pesticide as well, and because it's altered at the genetic level, that genetic material can then be carried over to bacteria in the gut. And then that the bacteria, they've actually found that the bacteria then begins to start producing this insecticide as well, or pesticide as well. And you know, therefore you've got in your gut a little factory of pesticide production, which you can imagine doesn't have the best effect on your health.
Well, pesticides, you know, they kill pests because
often they're like neurotoxic to the pests, and you know, it has the same sort of effects on us.
Yeah, pesticides have been linked with Parkinson's disease because it's neurotoxic to the pests. Yeah. It's neurotoxic to our brains as well.
Yeah.
What Doug is basically saying is true, but he should have said herbicide instead of pesticide.
Oh, right, so. Herbicide. Sorry. Yeah, it's an herbicide.
One thing, too, I wanted to mention about this genetically modified bacteria is another thing that it does, right, it mutates into the soil, right? And I was listening to one expert speak, and he was saying that basically once this genetically modified bacteria enters the soil and mutates, it takes over all the other natural bacterias. And they're saying basically of about 10 years of growing GMO crops that this bacteria will become dominant and irreplaceable. So if you're a conventional farmer who plants in this soil later on down the road, that now this GMO bacteria can infect your vegetables and your crops, and they have no idea what it will do in the long term.
Yeah, I think that's like one of the big important issues with genetically modified technology, like just the GMO technology, is that there are so many unknowns. They just don't know what this stuff is doing. You know, there can be mutations, there can be all kinds of mistakes made, and you know, once it's out in the environment and it starts, you know, intermingling with all the natural stuff that's out there, all these other different factors that we don't know about end up coming into the mix. So it's really like we've just opening Pandora's box is really a good description of what's going on here, because it's such a big unknown. We have no idea.
What is being genetically modified nowadays, especially in the U.S.?
Mostly in the U.S. right now, it's corn and soybeans. And about 80% of all processed foods that you would buy in a supermarket contain GMO. And they're not required to label any GMO products.
Yeah.
In fact, if you're even labeling non-GMO, they're coming under fire by the biotech companies.
Yeah. The real issue is that companies that do kind of have a conscience about this stuff, and they know that that this stuff is bad, or at least they know that people are becoming more aware of it and that it's affecting sales, who do label their products as non-GMO, and you can find some products now that have a GMO with a slash through it that basically means they aren't using any genetically modified ingredients in their products. They're starting to come under fire a bit, like Dave was saying. So you particularly see this with the RGBH in the States, which is the genetically modified bovine growth hormone that's being put being used on dairy producing cows. And you know, some of the producers out there who aren't using this this hormone want to label their milk as being free of this hormone, but the FDA is preventing them from doing that because they, according to them, it's no different. And to label it as different implies that it's better, and according to them, that's not fair. Last time, I haven't been in the U.S. in a while, but last time I was there, you still could find that milk would say that it didn't use the genetically modified growth hormone in it, but my understanding is that they're trying to get rid of that that labeling. So then you really have no way of telling whether the milk you're buying has this this genetically modified hormone in it.
One more thing I'd like to mention about the process of making GMOs is basically when they create these GMO products, what they do is they take like a microscopic BB. I think it's a gold BB, and they might have changed it now. But they basically blast it with about a .22 caliber blast. So what they're doing is blasting these genes. Say, you take a spider gene and you blast it into a tomato. And what happens is What they have in there is what is called a marker gene or an on and off gene. So basically what happens is it's Russian roulette with the genes.
And Dr. Jeffrey Smith talked about this in his genetic roulette book about these on and off genes. When they enter the human body, they can turn certain genes on and off, meaning cancer or other sicknesses or allergies. And it's definitely unknown.
Yeah, it's basically a total crapshoot. You know, they're firing these genes in there. It may have the effect that they're looking for, but there could be any other number of genes that end up getting turned off or turned on completely by accident. It really is. They want you to believe that it's a very precise science and that what they're doing is, you know, going to save the world and all this kind of stuff. But it's a very imprecise science. It's in its infancy and they don't really know what they're doing. And really, when you look at it with, the fact that they, you know, it's not labeled, it's being put out there in your supermarket, foods you're buying have this genetic modified material in it. You know, we're one giant experiment. You know, we don't know what this stuff is going to do to us. Despite the assurances from these big biotech companies, the tests they've run have been, you know, minor. They really have not looked carefully into what this stuff is doing. So, it's like, you know, welcome to the experiment because you're in it.
Lab rats.
Oh, God.
Exactly.
It's just astonishing how they can get away with that. And what will be your recommendations to people, both you as organic farmers? How can we be basically genetically modified foods free?
Well, the best thing that a consumer can do is become informed, know what you're eating, buy organic, get to know your local farmers, you know, have a relationship with them. That's the best way you can be assured of what's in your food.
There's also, again, Dr. Jeffrey Smith has a responsibletechnology.org website, and you can print up the non-GMO shopping guide where it has an extensive list of products that are not genetically modified. So when, as a consumer, you can have what he calls the tipping point. So we can overcome these biotech companies by not supporting them with our dollars. If you know, based on the shopping guide, that there's a product that is GMO-free and it costs a little bit more, then spend your extra money voting that way to support these companies that are making a point to not use genetically modified organisms in their food.
Vote with your dollar. That's the best. That's the, you know, the best way to get the message across.
And what about this frankenfish that has been in the news lately?
Yeah, that's something that's it's up for approval right now in the States with the FDA. It's a genetically modified salmon. You know, it's getting nicknamed the frankenfish.
That sounds pretty scary.
Yeah, it is scary, and you know, it's a pretty appropriate title for that very reason because it is a scary thing. What it basically is they've taken the genes from other fish to splice them into a salmon. And so it's the genes from an ocean pout, which is kind of an eel-like fish, and another type of salmon. They splice these in together. And what they basically have is a fish that grows twice as fast as a regular salmon, so it reaches market. Instead of taking about 3 years to get to market, it's done in about a year and a half. So realistically, this doesn't benefit anybody except for the producers. You know, the end consumer has gets no benefit from this whatsoever. And you know, the science that's behind it is all produced by the actual company that's producing this fish. It's called Aqua Bounty, and you know, all the science that the FDA is reviewing on this has all come from this company. So there's no independent research coming to it. So, I mean, right there you can see, you know, this is not objective material that they're looking at. And the scientific material, while it is kind of some of it's kept kind of under wraps, people who have reviewed it have basically said it's completely inadequate. They've not looked at the dangers of one of these salmons actually escaping into the environment, you know, maybe intermingling and interbreeding with the existing salmon. They haven't, you know, there's another problem, too, that it looks like the allergenicity of mm-hmm. this salmon. So in other words, people who are allergic to fin fish, you know, how they react to this salmon, there's enough evidence to state that they will actually react more strongly to this genetically modified salmon. But, you know, Aqua Bounty has stated that it's statistically insignificant because they only tested it on six fish. And, you know, then they found a 20% rise in the allergenicity, but they said it's not statistically significant. Well, you know, how can it be statistically significant when they only tested six fish? Hmm. So, I mean, you know, they're cutting corners left and right and basically just trying to slide this thing through. Now, luckily, people have become more aware of this. I think because it's such a landmark thing, this will be the very first genetically modified animal. You know, we've had plants, you know, genetically modified plants around for quite a while, but this will be the first genetically modified animal for human consumption. So it's a landmark case, and I think they were just hoping that they could slide it through, that they've slid through everything else, all the other genetically modified stuff, but people are actually up in arms about this thing. The salmon industry, for one, because the FDA has already stated that they will not allow labeling of the genetically modified salmon. So the salmon industry is obviously up in arms about this because their sales are going to suffer. You know, if you're trying to avoid genetically modified foods and you know that some salmon is genetically modified, you know, I personally wouldn't take the risk. You know, that's it. Salmon's done. I'm not going to eat salmon anymore. And there's a lot of people out there who feel that way as well. So, yeah, it could actually signal the death of the salmon industry if enough people are fed up and just won't take the risk.
And again, going back to the consumer knowing if it's labeled that they're not going to buy the salmon because it's going to have on there that it's genetically modified, and as the word gets out and more people get educated about it, Aqua Bounty, I'm sure, has spent millions of dollars in this project and a lot of mm-hmm. energy, and they don't want people even looking at the difference between...
They don't want losses.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of their ways of doing it. You know, they assume that a, you know, not very aware customer is just going to not think about it and buy the fish. Yeah. Yeah.
What about the EnviroPig that I heard?
Oh, yeah. See, the thing about this salmon, it is such a landmark case. If this one comes through, then there's a very good chance that future genetically modified animals for human consumption will, you know, it sets the precedent. So then more of these animals can come to market. And what they've been working on up in Canada, actually at Guelph University, they've been genetically modified a pig, and they're calling it EnviroPig, ironically enough.
Jesus.
You know, what they've basically done is genetically modified this pig so that it can break down phosphates better than you know, a natural pig can, because the problem with when they have these giant factory farms with you know, hundreds of thousands of pigs under one roof, the manure that's coming out of there is so great that it has a huge impact on the environment wherever they're dumping this stuff. So one of the problems with that is the phosphates. You know, it leads to kind of algal blooms and stuff like that in the waterways, and like all this you know, it's very polluting is basically what it is. So they've genetically modified this pig so that it has an enzyme that will break down this you know, phosphate matter, so that it doesn't have as great an impact on the environment. And you know, they're trying to sell this basically as an environmentally friendly factory farmed pig, which, you know, the concept is ridiculous, of course, but you know, they're just taking the totally wrong tack on this. And I mean, they are with all genetically modified stuff. You know, there's better solutions to these problems that doesn't involve, you know, fiddling with this science. You know, like a kid with a nuclear weapon or something like that. It's just like completely irresponsible. So yeah, there's this pig could very well be the second genetically modified animal that ends up on the market if this salmon ends up going through.
And imagine what that would do to your health and wellness if you're eating a pig that breaks down the phosphates or whatnot. Imagine what it would do to your digestive system. when you eat it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It comes back to the known unknowns. They really don't know what this is going to do to the environment. And now you're releasing this genetically modified manure or crap into the water. Who knows what it's going to produce? What kind of, you know, genetically modified bacteria? I mean, they really don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. Or more super weeds.
Well, yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the super weeds?
Well, super weeds are basically weeds that have become resistant to the Roundup Ready crops and some of these GMO crops that have these herbicides into them. So as a farmer, as you grow these GMO crops, the weeds become more and more resistant, so you have to use more and more of the herbicides, or the insects build up a resistance, so you have to use more and more, which just contaminates the environment more and more.
It sounds very profitable for the ones who sell.
Yes, of course, if you got to keep buying more products from, you know, the biotech companies, it just makes them richer and richer.
And it also contaminates the water that people are drinking.
And impoverishes the soil from nutrients.
And it also, you know, the natural, you know, the animals in the environment that are used to, you know, feeding on this kind of stuff, like, you know, like bees or, you know, whatever else, insects, birds, those sorts of things, they're getting this genetically modified stuff as well. And Dave, actually, you were telling me earlier about like some incident in India with cattle grazing on cotton plants or something like that.
Yeah, there's some reports in India of livestock that got into GMO cotton fields, and I think it was cows in particular, but they were eating the cotton, and they were dying very fast afterwards. And it's still kind of a mystery, but we think it might be to the fact that they're getting this GMO bacteria into their guts, and they're not able to process their food. So we still don't know. It's once again, a known unknown.
Yeah, yeah. And there, I think there was, like, Indian farmers committing suicides over this as well. And
well, what seems to be the problem is in India is the farmers have basically been tricked into buying this GMO seed, right? What do they call them? The Terminator seeds. So they can grow one generation of a crop from these GMO seeds, and then they have to buy seeds again the next year from the biotech companies, and so they're basically being held hostage to buy their seeds. As a result, the farmers are getting into debt, and they're getting so far into debt that they're committing suicide to avoid their families having to pay off the debts that they owe to these biotech companies.
And Dr. Vandana Shiva, she was in the documentary The Corporation. She's done extensive research about this and has spoken a lot about it. And basically she's saying it's the new colonialism, that to the seed is the power of life. And her suggestion for many people is to start saving seeds, to keep a supply of seeds. So as these biotech corporations take over and control food and therefore control the people, us as small farmers or even garden farmers or people who are just interested in having a collection of you know, heirloom seeds that they can pass on down generations.
One thing I'd like to add, too, and kind of relates to this, is the fact that the biotech companies are using the propaganda that GMOs are required to feed the world, that they're going to save the world from hunger. But the reality is there's a lot of studies coming in now that show just the opposite, that actually food production is decreasing from the use of GMOs.
By the way, The Corporation is a great documentary that everybody should watch, because basically it portrays how corporations work, and they make the comparison with a psychopathic personality.
Yeah, these biotech corporations, and I won't name them by name, but anyone who has half a brain would probably know. Some of the tactics they use are basically, say you're growing corn next to genetically modified corn, and their pollen goes into your corn and contaminates it. Now, by law, they have the rights to all your seed. Now, what they've been doing is hiring private detectives. Even Blackwater has been involved to spy on activists against GMOs.
What is black water for some of our listeners who don't know?
Basically, black water is a mercenary army that has been in the news recently in Iraq and Afghanistan, where basically they run wild and they're not accountable to military laws and rules.
Oh, private pretty, corporation.
Yeah, sounds pretty criminal.
Yeah, absolutely. Like these companies are bad people. Like there's no getting around that. It is like, you know, they have an agenda. They want to completely control the food supply of the entire world, and they're not afraid to use any devious tactic they can possibly use. And you know, Dave is a bit hesitant to name them, and I don't blame him a bit, because you know, people do come under fire when they do mention that sort of thing.
Yeah, just in the state where we live, these biotech companies are coming in and offering job incentives, and it's very hard as small organic farmers to fight against companies with so much money. And, you know, one of the criticisms that we receive when we're trying to educate people about this is we're not supporting, you know, the economy of our state. And really what's happening is, because Hawaii is so isolated, it's a testing ground, and they're not growing food to sell to people in Hawaii or to even feed. They are doing experimental crops. They're doing experimental seeds that involve pharmacopoeia. And because Hawaii has 4 growing seasons, we can produce a mass amount of seeds that are shipped all throughout the U.S.
One thing I'd just like to throw in there is near where my farm is, there's one of these biotech corporations, and you should see the way it's set up. It is like a prison. They have huge barbed-wired fences. They have guards. Even their trailers, their headquarters, where their executives stay, they have bulletproof glass. So, you know, what's up with the bulletproof glass? Excuse me.
And I'll just add that, again, Hawaii was an agriculture state for many years, and because of the warm climate and the 4 growing seasons, people could produce food year-round. Mm-hmm. And now all the arid land that's available, since Hawaii no longer grows sugarcane, is being sold off in large tracts to these biotech companies. So small farmers who maybe only want 1 acre or 2 acres cannot compete on that market, because there's no competing with a corporation that has millions of dollars at its dispense.
Yeah. So, I mean, the only thing we can really do is like refuse to buy this stuff. You know, if enough of us, it's like Jeffrey Smith talks about the tipping point. You know, if enough of us are aware and enough of us are refusing to buy this stuff, then it will make a difference. You know, food processors, when their sales start to go down because they might have genetically modified stuff in them, they'll stop doing it. You know, they'll stop using this stuff. So, you know, we got to hit them where it hurts, which is in the wallet. You know, you have to vote with your dollar.
Yeah, recently the company Sara Lee stopped producing their products with high fructose corn syrup because consumers were very concerned, and they were writing and calling, and they received enough negative publicity from it that they made an announcement that they would no longer produce their products, I think it was 2 products in particular, made with high fructose corn syrup. And that's information is in the Dot Connector magazine.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's great news. You know, it's funny, the high fructose corn syrup, people are actually changing the name high fructose corn syrup. I believe they're changing it to corn sugar, because, you know, people don't know what corn sugar is, but they know what high fructose corn syrup is. So keep your eyes open for that.
Speaking of the Dot Connector magazine, you wrote an article recently for the Dot Connector magazine about, you know, the vegetarian hypotheses and saturated fats. Can you talk us a little bit for those who cannot get the magazine?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically the premise of the article was that, you know, more and more, you know, healthy eating is kind of being associated with, you know, not eating meat. So it's a meatless diet. You know, the health food movement is kind of going more and more towards vegetarianism. And basically, the article was just sort of questioning this. And, you know, it's kind of the politically correct thing to do, to not want to eat animals. And, you know, it's understandable. You know, I think that people are kind of confronted with these images of factory farms where, you know, there's obvious suffering going on there and these animals are being treated like inhumanely, and they just want to completely turn around and run in the opposite direction, and they run to maybe a bit too far into vegetarianism and veganism. But really what needs to be understood is that this is a moral decision, and it is not necessarily the ideal diet for human beings.
So let's talk a little bit about what is a healthy diet. We all here have made changes in our diet and have benefited enormously, and we want to share a little bit about this. Dave and Erica, can you talk a little bit about, you know, how your health has benefited from these dietary changes, and basically what were the dietary changes?
Well, for me, I started with getting rid of all gluten products and dairy. And before I did that, I had a very serious acid reflux problem, and it created ulcers in my stomach. The doctor wanted to do an operation, but I didn't really want to do that. So I got off the gluten and the dairy, and almost immediately the acid. In fact, I've never had acid reflux again as a result, and my energy levels have increased. I feel like I was 18 again.
That's pretty amazing. How about you, Eric?
Yes, I was suffering from severe migraine headaches. And again, you know, I was given the suggestion to take migraine prescriptions and Tylenol and all these things. And I went to a naturopathic doctor who, again, suggested get off the gluten and the dairy. And I can say in the past 3 years, I have not suffered a migraine headache. And I realized how much the food was infecting my health. And people say, well, how could you get a migraine headache from something that you eat? And maybe Gabby can explain more about the medical basis behind that. But I can tell you, with children and a job, you have a migraine headache, you're debilitated. And if it was as easy as not having a piece of bread or eating that piece of cake, it was worth it. And I will never go back.
Yes. Basically, the gist of it is that we as a modern society has based our diet in grains, in dairy. It constitutes the base of the food pyramid. The nutrition, you know, the recommended food pyramid. But it's important to take into consideration that this food pyramid is made by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It's not really the U.S. Department of Nutrition or Health. Yeah. So basically, we're eating what it's being produced. It's not necessarily what is healthier for us. There is a great percentage of the population who is intolerant to gluten. And gluten basically is the protein in wheat, but in all grains as well. It is what makes batter, you know, sticky, you know.
Viscous.
It's basically the sticky, viscous part that makes, bread being, you know, so. It's basically the sticky part of the protein that makes it ideal to make certain breads and pastas, etc. And gluten intolerance has been linked with over 300 diseases, basically. Not only celiac disease, but, you know, basically numerous hundreds of diseases. And we have an interview with Dr. Peter Osborne from glutenfreesociety.org in the issue of Dot Connector magazine. And basically what he explains is this, how gluten is for those who are gluten intolerant, which is a great percentage of the population, is gluten intolerance is behind, chronic diseases, chronic degenerative diseases.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting to see how dairy and gluten are very similar in the structure as well. And this is why us as researchers and our readers have benefited so much from eliminating these two products from their diets.
Yeah, I think, just from being a nutritionist, from what I've seen as well, I mean, I personally have cut out both gluten and dairy as well as a few other things that weren't really working for me. And I've seen remarkable improvements. But I think one of the important things to realize is that most people out there listening right now are probably thinking, oh, well, that's not me. You know, I don't have a gluten intolerance. I know I eat bread all the time, and I'm fine. It makes up a good part of my diet. No. But what people don't realize that it is, it's a silent killer. I mean, maybe not literally a killer, but a lot of people who are suffering from some kind of degenerative disease, or even like, you know, just these minor nagging symptoms like, you know, psoriasis or eczema or like, you know, anything like irritable bowel, all these kinds of things could be because you are intolerant to gluten or dairy. So I actually, I write for a site, a health site called thatsfit.ca. I write a regular blog for them. And on that blog over the summer, I did what I call the 30-day challenge, where I just challenged readers to go 30 days without wheat, gluten, sugar, caffeine, or alcohol. I think that was all of them. Uh-huh. And man, the reports coming back were unbelievable. Like people just talking about, I have so much more energy, I feel so much better, you know, this cleared up or that cleared up or whatever. You know, there was one woman on there who had been meaning to start jogging for a long time, but just, you know, she'd get home from work and just be exhausted. And she wrote to me, she's, you know, after about 1 week on the diet, she was out there jogging like, you know, miles a day or something like that. I don't remember exactly how far it was, but honestly, like, you know, people need to realize that that, you know, this stuff just really isn't suitable for the human diet. So, you know, it's all well and good to say, well, it's not me, but until you really actually try eliminating this stuff for an extended period of time, you just don't know. You have no way of knowing whether, you know, unless you are of perfect health, and I've never met anybody who is, so unless you're of perfect health, it might be worth a try.
That's a very important point, because there is a strong scientific argument against gluten and also dairy.
Yeah.
And gluten, again, repeating, it's in all grains. Basically, the safe gluten-free products are only amaranth, buckwheat, quinoa, and wild rice. And they are pseudo-cereals. They are not cereals, and that's why they don't contain gluten.
That's an important point, actually, because it is a very wide misconception that, you know, that the gluten grains are only wheat, barley, rye, spelt, and kamut. Maybe there's a couple of others in there that I missed, but and that the rest of the grains are all fine, like corn and rice. Oh, yeah, those are gluten-free. It's no problem. But in the most recent issue of Doc Connector, there's that interview with Dr. Peter Osborne,
mm-hmm.
And he points out that actually all grains have gluten. It's a component of every grain. It's one of the things that makes a grain, is that it has gluten in it. You know, it's a different type of gluten in every grain, and some of them... you know, I think the division that's in there, that some grains are safe and some aren't, is that, you know, celiac disease, which is only one manifestation of gluten sensitivity, seems to only manifest with those particular grains. But, you know, gluten sensitivity could be causing any number of problems, not just celiac disease, as Dr. Segura was saying here. And you might be having these silent effects to something like rice, you know, or to corn, or mm-hmm. something like that. Like it's not necessarily going to be blatant, you know, that you're reacting to this gluten.
And many of the gluten-free products that are sold on the market now, as we've learned in our research, are based on products like corn. And
yes.
Again, getting
and
back
rice,
to the
yeah.
genetically modified
corn
aspect
has
of
gluten.
Corn.
Yes, and a great percentage, by the way. Yeah. And I have some very good news for our listeners. We're going to publish Dr. Peter Osborne's interview as a podcast in SOT.net. So stay in tune, and you'll get a chance to listen to it. But then we go to the following question. So then what do we eat?
Yeah.
If you don't eat grains, you don't need wheat, dairy, what do you eat? Okay, so what do we eat?
Buckwheat. Yeah, there's definitely there's still a few grains like was mentioned before, you know, buckwheat, quinoa, amaranth, and wild rice, right?
And lots of organic vegetables.
Yeah, very important.
Lots of organic vegetables, very important. But you know, these non-grains, you know, these grain-like seeds, you can use them to substitute quite a few things. So you know, it's not completely hopeless.
Yes, with buckwheat flour, you can make blinis. There's quinoa pasta. There's buckwheat pasta. Basically, the blinis are like a substitute for bread. You can make little pizzas with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I make, you know, you can do buckwheat crepes as well, and then you can make wraps with those, so you don't have to kiss sandwiches goodbye. I think that's good for a lot of people out there who like their sandwiches.
And we'll post a few links because we have cooking videos on how to make these foods.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's not all bad news.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, you can make some really delicious gluten-free, dairy-free recipes, even desserts. So don't feel like you have to give up everything or give up the pleasure of eating.
Yeah, we were just before the podcast eating some chocolate pudding made from avocados and cocoa powder.
It was great.
Yeah, it was really delicious.
Delicious.
You don't feel deprived at all. I mean, it is, there's no denying that it is a challenge. You know, we're in a society that has based its entire diet around these harmful products, you know, like, you know, wheat is in almost everything that you find at the grocery store or in restaurants and all these kinds of things. It's a difficult, thing to do. But, you know, if once you commit to it, and you kind of have to get over that hump of figuring out what can I eat. You know, you figure out some new recipes, you figure out some tricks. And, you know, you get yourself involved in a community of people who are trying to do these things as well. And there's some support there. And, you know, after a while, you don't feel deprived at all. I mean, at first it was kind of hard because you go to a restaurant with friends or something like that and you look down the menu and it's like, oh, well, there's nothing here I can eat. And it's difficult. There's no doubt. But, you know, once you have kind of committed to it and you know that, there are things that you can do, you figure out ways to kind of get around that. And it's, you won't regret it. It actually, you feel much better.
And when your health issues clear up, you realize how much these foods have contributed to low energy, brain fog,
exactly.
Stress.
Mood problems.
Yes.
A lot of people don't make the connection of what they eat and how it affects to their mood. Like depression, anxiety, stress in general. You know, you cannot concentrate. You have problems of memory.
Or just being exhausted all the time.
Exactly.
I mean, that was one of the things I noticed. You know, you come home from work at night and you're just like, oh, collapse on the couch. You don't want to make dinner. You just order takeout. Like, you just have no energy. And, you know, once you make these dietary changes, I mean, it may sound like a big deal right now and like, oh, I can't possibly do that. But, you know, once you make the changes and you have more energy, and that makes making these changes even easier. You know, you have the energy to come home from work and start cooking a meal. You know, it's not that difficult to do.
And another important point is do not be afraid of fats. And I say this as a heart surgeon. And I have here a little review of an article that is going to be published in the next issue of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Now, this study followed more than 58,000 Japanese adults over a 14-year period and assessed the relationship between their saturated fat intake and risk death from a variety of cardiovascular diseases. Now, cardiovascular disease is basically an umbrella term that essentially covers stroke, or any conditions related to heart disease or vascular disease, arterial disease, atherosclerosis, you know, peripheral artery disease, heart attacks, angina, etc. Now, what is interesting is that this study linked higher saturated fat intake with reduced risk of cardiovascular disease. Reduced risk. And that's a little bit shocking because a lot of people say, oh, saturated fat equals atherosclerosis disease. They say this as a heart surgeon. Your problem is not saturated fat. Problem, you know, you can search the root of the problem in grains, in dairy, in processed foods, and a high intake of sugar, you know, fructose converts into fat in our bodies. And so, yeah, this study, it's published in a mainstream scientific journal, the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And basically, according to the findings of the authors of this article, if the Japanese were to increase their saturated fat intake, heart disease deaths would stay the same, stroke deaths would go down, and so would deaths due to vascular disease overall. So that's
you know, the whole that doesn't surprise me that they're having those findings. Actually, what surprises me that is actually getting published in a mainstream journal.
That's true.
Yeah, because you know the saturated fats have been demonized for the last half century or even longer actually. In the 1950s, there was a researcher named Ansel Keys who, he did something, it's a famous study now called the Seven Countries Study. And what he did was he related, heart disease with, saturated fat consumption in seven different countries.
Uh-huh.
So he looked at all these different countries and, you know, he saw a relationship. The more saturated fat that people ate, the, higher the heart disease rates. Well, unfortunately, he actually started off with 22 countries, the data for 22 countries, and he just kind of threw out the data that didn't conform to his hypothesis. This is otherwise known as really bad science. So basically, you know, this is what started off the whole saturated fat, the lipid hypothesis, as it has come to be called, that, you know, the idea that, you know, you eat saturated fat causes your cholesterol to go up, and then cholesterol clogs your veins. And, you know, each step in that hypothesis is wrong, you know. This one study, you know, it's Ansel Keys was made Man of the Year by Time magazine in, I think it was like 1955 or something like that. And, you know, there was a big push to accept this lipid hypothesis and really get it out to everybody. And we've basically all been brainwashed with it. There's not a person on the street that you could find right now who would actually tell you that saturated fats are beneficial to health. It's been so widespread.
Fat is very important to our health. It basically, fat constitutes all the membranes of all your cells of your body. A high percentage of of our brains are made out of fat. And also fat is precursor for hormones. The problem is the difference between bad fats and good fats. And that's what most people, you know, are misinformed. People don't know what are bad fats.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole lipid hypothesis has been pushing people away from saturated fats and towards vegetable oils instead. So, you know, you have, instead of eating these, you know, animal fats or, you know, natural saturated fats from vegetables like coconut oil. Palm oil, exactly. Or, you know, from animal fats like butter or ghee.
Lard.
Yeah, lard. You know, all the traditional fats that our grandparents were cooking with, basically, before heart disease was really a problem,
yes.
Oddly enough. You know, we're all switching to these vegetable oils now, and these vegetable oils, you know, all the plastic bottles you see lining your grocery store shelves and stuff like that, the corn oil, the sunflower oil, the safflower oil, all these oils are actually quite damaging. We are not, I mean, those are polyunsaturated fats, and, you know, I won't go into too much detail here.
But now that you mentioned plastic, you know, processed vegetable oil is like a one step away from actually being a plastic.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, these oils are not, you know, they're more often than not, they're rancid. They cause damage when you consume them. They're not fit for human consumption. I wouldn't oil my bike chain with them, to be perfectly honest. Like, they're terrible things. And, you know, this is what we've all been pushed towards. And, you know, they demonize butter. So they make these spreads by hydrogenating, a vegetable oil, turning it all into hydrogenated fats, trans fats, all these, you know, just this garbage. And we've all been like clogging ourselves with this stuff and like clogging our arteries and whatever else. I mean, these are the damaging fats, not the saturated fats.
If you eat plastic, your body will turn into plastic.
Yeah, yeah, big surprise.
You eat, you are what you eat, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the trans fats that are found so often in these processed foods, these are the real like damaging fats. You know, you think about the fact that your cells are made up of these fats. The cell walls are all made up of fats. Well, you mean your body knows what to do with, you know, natural fats, and it incorporates them into the cell walls. It doesn't know what to do with these trans fats.
Exactly.
And it puts them in those cell walls as well. And then your cell walls end up not functioning properly. Then nutrients can't get into your cells.
Causes inflammation in your body.
Yeah.
You know, inflammation behind all chronic diseases, all disease, inflammation.
I mean, it short circuits the communication that happens in your body, the necessary communication. And it just leads to degrading health. Eat the right fat. Don't be afraid of the saturated fats. Those are the good ones.
So a recapitulation, what are good fats or what can we use for cooking?
Oh, okay. Ideally, the most stable fats are the saturated fats. So the ones that are the most stable to heats. So that would include lard, beef tallow, butter, ghee, coconut oil, palm oil. These are the and duck fat. Yeah, sorry, can't forget that one. Duck fat as well. You know, the French have been eating pounds and pounds of duck fat like for as long as you can remember. And we all know that the French have a lower incidence of heart disease than North Americans do. Mm-hmm. Everybody's like, oh, the French paradox. Why are these French people not having more heart disease than us when they eat way more saturated fat? Well, that's why. It's because they're eating saturated fat. They're not eating these fake fats. They're not eating vegetable oil or anything. They're frying their food in duck fat and lard and like.
And it's not necessarily about the wine, as they will want us to believe, because they have higher percentages of liver disease.
Yeah, exactly.
Much more than the Americans.
Alcohol is not the answer. Yeah, the whole idea that, you know, they've isolated that one high antioxidant found in red wine called resveratrol.
Uh-huh.
The whole idea that resveratrol is what's preventing all this heart disease, you have to like consume tons of resveratrol to have an effect that they're saying that it has. So
not your average glass of wine.
No, it's not a glass of wine with dinner that's helping people. The Sardinian diet that everybody was freaking out over a little while ago was like, it was like a Mediterranean style diet, and one of the things that they were saying is they have a very resveratrol rich wine that they tend to drink there. It's a very dark wine, so everybody's scrambling to get their hands on this wine. You know, oh, this is going to solve my heart disease problem. It's so ridiculous. I mean, just stop eating the bad fat.
Yeah, people do not drink alcohol either, because the liver is working overtime to try to detox all the toxicity that we're exposed to nowadays. And this could be a theme for another podcast, because it's quite a subject with all the mercury toxicity, the Gulf oil spill, basically all the toxicity that we're exposed on a daily basis in our world. Do not overtax your liver by drinking more alcohol.
Yeah, you're not solving any problems. Don't believe the hype on the red wine.
Other than saturated fat, as we just talked about it, there is also fish oil. Mm-hmm. Omega-3s, polyunsaturated fats like olive oil, they're very good for your health. And they're not ideal for cooking. They're not as stable as saturated fat, but they're good oils. Just, you know, can you talk a little bit about the importance of fish oil in our health?
Yeah, sure. So the polyunsaturated oils are, there's two that are essential fats. And that's the omega-3s and the omega-6s. And unfortunately, the modern Western diet is extremely high in omega-6 fats. And you tend to find those in the seed oils, corn oil, sunflower oil, the ones I was mentioning before, the ones you tend to find in the plastic bottles. And they tend to actually remove the omega-3 fats from there, because they're so unstable and they'll go rancid so much faster. So rather than sell an oil that'll go bad very quickly, they remove all the healthy omega-3s from that and just sell you an omega-6 oil so it won't go rancid as fast. Now, ironically, these fats are very unstable and should never be heated, but yet they're selling them for cooking. Now, what has been found is that actually the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 fats in the body is extremely important. And if you have too many omega-6s versus omega-3s, it can lead to inflammatory conditions. It can lead to just all sorts of problems. And while the ratio, there's some debate as to what the ratio should be. Udo Erasmus wrote in his book about 20 years ago called Fats That Heal, Fats That Kill, that you probably want about 3 times omega-3. So the ratio should be omega-6 to omega-3 should be 3 to 1. So 3 times as much omega-6 as omega-3. I've read more recently that people have found that it may actually be a 1-to-1 ratio that you're looking for. Now, compare this to the average North American who's eating these vegetable oils and stuff has more like 30-to-1 type ratio. So it's just so out of whack. And you can see it. I mean, everybody's walking around inflamed. Obesity is an inflammation condition. So, I mean, yeah, yeah. Now, I mean, these fats are essential. Like, you do need to get them from outside sources. In other words, we can't make these fats from other fats. So you do need to get them from outside sources. But if you're getting so much omega-6 and not enough omega-3, then that's going to lead to problems as well. So ideally what needs to be done when you first kind of start down this road to getting your health back on your feet is to supplement with fish oil. Fish oil is a form of omega-3 that the body can use right away. There's two types called DHA and EPA, and I won't pronounce what those stand for because they're big, long, confusing terms. So, and I'll probably mispronounce them. So, anyway, DHA and EPA found in fish oil are the types of fats that your body can use right away. Now, you can also find omega-3s in some seeds, like flax seeds and chia seeds, a few other places as well. But your body does have to convert those omega-3s to DHA and EPA. So ideally you're taking in fish oil and maybe flax oil as well, just to as kind of a backup. But you know vegetarians who insist on not taking anything from an animal product and are not taking in fish oil, you have to realize that you're 100% relying on your body being able to make that conversion from the flax oil. So the type of fat in flax oil is called ALA, alpha-linolenic acid. And so you're relying that your body is able to convert the ALA to EPA and DHA. And not everybody can do it that well.
Yeah. Some people cannot make that conversion, and they will have a chronic deficiency of these important fats.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm saying is don't depend entirely on seeds to be able to get your omega-3s. Because you can see people who are taking flax oil daily and they still are showing signs of omega-3 deficiency.
It can be from depression to chronic diseases in the skin like psoriasis. And it can be omega-3s, are really very important for our health. Deficiency in omega-3s, it is linked also with chronic diseases as well. So we go again about the importance of healthy fats in our diet. And another important thing that I want to mention is that a higher intake of fat, it stimulates your vagus nerve. Now, the vagus nerve, it's very important because it's the heart of your anti-stress system, of your nervous system that is anti-stress. It is also anti-inflammatory. It's the vagus nerve is the heart also of an anti-inflammatory pathway in our bodies. And the reason I mention this as well is because we have a program that is relaxing, anti-stress, rejuvenating, and it's called areolas. And areolas basically stimulates the vagus nerve naturally with breathing and meditation, and it helps us to regain our health. It's also therapeutic, but preventive, and it has a cumulative beneficial effect. Stimulating the vagus nerve is very important. We can do it with a diet high in fat, but we can also do it through this program, Areolas. It's available at eebreathe.org.
Yeah, and I'd like to mention that we were just at the first international Areolas conference where we ate plenty of saturated fat and buckwheat pancakes.
Vegetables as well.
And vegetables as well. And we learned with over 70 people about the importance of stimulating the vagus nerve. And we practiced the program together, and everyone left feeling feeling rejuvenated, healthy, and ready to deal with the stresses of daily life.
It was a great success. It was an amazing experience, like, you know, an amazing group therapy, like, never seen before.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I feel great. I got to eat lots of bacon, so all you bacon lovers.
And homemade sausage.
We have a cooking video of homemade sausage as well. We'll make sure to post the links to everybody who's interested in checking our cooking videos. And for those interested in getting the magazine, it is available at the .connectyourmagazine.org. And the Aerialist program is available at eebreathe.com or .org. And thanks to all our listeners for being with us tonight. And thanks to Dave, Erica, and Douglas. And Douglas for being here tonight at Thought.net podcast. And until the next time, aloha.
Ahui ho.
Good night.
Bye-bye.